Greetings everybody around the world. It's time once again for Ancient Aliens Radio. This is the dedicated radio show for the cast of Ancient Aliens. Here we interview authors and researchers as an ongoing investigation into the ancient alien theory. Don't forget to like us on Facebook or subscribe to the YouTube channel Ancient Aliens Radio. We've got a nice special show today. We got my good friend Robert Boval back, but today we're going to be talking about his book, The Vatican Heresy, who he's co-authored with two other authors, a nice collaboration. And we have, with Robert Boval today, we have Sandro Zicari, PhD. And Sandro is in Italy, Robert is in Spain, and myself in Ireland. And we have three countries linked up, so it's quite an exciting format today. So without further ado, let's get the show started. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Capricorn Radio.
Hello. Hello. James, nice to be back.
Well, hi, Robert. Hi, Sandro.
Hi, James.
Wow. Robert, here we are today. We're going to talk about this Vatican heresy. This is different for you, Robert. This is a U-turn from your usual work. I'd like to think so, but there is astronomy involved. The faithful, the science of astronomy. It's quite a mix of hodgepodge of ideas, but I can see where you've gone with this book, Robert. It's a fascinating read. Really is, but I guess the most important thing is to explain who our guest is and how you guys know each other and how the collaboration kind of came about, Robert.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, you're right. I mean, this topic isn't my normal topic. As you know, my books are mainly about ancient Egypt and the pyramids of Egypt, but I'll explain how Sandra and I met. In very simple terms, I had written a book with Graham Hancock in 2004 called Talisman. And in that book, we reviewed the influence of the Hermetic tradition, which started in Egypt in the first century BC, and was rediscovered in Italy during the Renaissance. So the book that I wrote with Hancock explored the influence of this tradition, particularly in secret societies like Freemasonry and Rosicrucians, and more especially on the architecture of modern cities. For example, the city of Paris, which we talked a lot in this book, and the city of Washington, very much influenced by Hermetic Masonic ideologies.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we touched upon Rome. And the reason we touched upon Rome, of course, apart from the fact that this is where the rediscovery of the Hermetic tradition occurred in Italy in the 15th century. What we were looking at was briefly the curious design of the Piazza St. Peter. So having said this, which is what this new book is all about. The Vatican Heresy is entirely focused on this design, as you will see as we explain in this interview. So, I always had at the back of my mind, you know, we should have explored much deeper into this, because there was a lot of things that didn't quite tie up when I wrote the book with Hancock.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, with all this in mind, there was a conference in 2012 in Italy, in Tuscany. And I was invited with a budget. I had a budget for two people, and my wife was going to come, and then she couldn't make it. So it so happened that I was contacted by a young lady called Chiara Dainelli, who is one of our co-authors now. And I offered the place. I mean, there was a free ticket. They were paying expenses and all that. So she came along.
Mm-hmm.
And at the conference... You know, we had already decided, I explained to her my idea about the book I had in mind, and she was very keen. I was interested in her because she had written a book on Dante.
Sure. She's been on the show as well, Robert. She's been on the show, The Astronomical Code of Dante.
Yes, yeah. Indeed, yes. Mm-hmm. You spoke to her. Well, she was Princess Chiara when you spoke to her, wasn't she?
Wow, yes.
Anyway,
that's
so
right, that's right.
Chiara was, a keen, follower of this astronomical studies on ancient architecture and ancient texts. So she got very interested, and it so happened that her mother was a professor of Latin. So I thought, yeah, good idea. Why don't you join me on a small level? I offered her a small part of the book. But by sheer coincidence, I mean, that morning at the conference, there was somebody sitting quietly at a breakfast table. And I don't know why. I mean, it's one of those strange things. I thought, I'll go and say hello. And it turned out to be Sandro Zicari. Hello, Sandro, you're there.
Yeah, I'm here.
You remember that?
Yeah, I was having dinner alone.
Was it dinner or breakfast?
At the At night.
Ah, okay. Well, you see how memory plays funny.
Yeah.
Yes.
I was having dinner, at the restaurant there, just alone, because I was come alone there. And you asked me to join with me. And, you began talking about your new project, with Chiara. And in that time, I was studying exactly the design of Piazza San Peter and its sun alignment.
Wow!
And so I take a pen and begin to write my theory on table.
On paper on the napkin.
Yeah, it's funny how these things begin. I mean, a lot of people who hopefully buy this book, many don't know how these books start, sometimes in very strange circumstances.
On a napkin, Robert.
Yeah, on a napkin. The back of an envelope or something. I mean, you reminded me when I was in the desert in 2008 with Tom Brophy, and we're sitting around the campfire, and while we were talking about the laptop lie, and then I said, why don't we write a book? You know, and there you are, the book eventually was written, Black Genesis. So that's how it started with you, Sandra. That's correct. And we met again, if I recall, in Rome, where we started talking more seriously about how to put this book together. Perhaps you should explain, Sandro, who you are.
Please do, Sandro.
They know who I am, so I think they should know who you are.
Yeah, this thing too is very, very funny, because I'm a statistician. I work at Sapienza University here in Rome, and as a statistician, but I'm very fascinating and interested in symbolism and its astronomical interpretation. We met again, I think some months after the first meeting, the first casual meeting. Yeah. And we began to design, to talk about this project.
Yeah. You know very well. I mean, of course, we don't need to tell each other our own story, but, one of the interesting, connection, and partnership was that you had access to, through the university, through some very, very, difficult, articles to get.
And documents,
And documents, right. Yes, because, I knew, and we both knew from the beginning that, we would need to dig deep into this. One of the reasons I remember we discussed earlier is that we were dealing with the 16th and 17th century, where, you know, the church was all powerful and people were afraid to express their views. You know, we talked a lot about this dissimulation culture that there was in Italy.
Do you speak Italian or Latin, Robert?
I speak Italian, yes.
Very
not
well.
As good as Sandro, of course.
No, very well.
Do you want us to speak a bit in Italian, James?
No, I'm just curious what it was like to collaborate in a different language for you, Robert. That's all.
Yeah, yeah. We talked in both languages. In fact, very often I talk to Sandro in Italian, and he talks to me in English. You know, we collaborate in both languages. Yeah. Sandro has participated deeply into the research of the original manuscript. And then, of course, Sandro, you did all the, you worked on the translation of the book, which is coming out next month in Italy. It was quite a job, this translation, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Sandro?
Yeah. It took me, I think, 5 months of, but the work is very, very well. The Italian version, I think, is very, very interesting too. It's, I think when you translate a book, it's often it's very difficult to translate the mood of the original work.
So absolutely,
I think we succeed in this aim. I'm very.
Let's get into the meat of the issue now, because
okay. So
really,
Robert,
what this book was.
Well,
and,
for me, Robert,
great.
The Vatican heresy, as it's called. Let's kind of label what the heresy is, Robert. Let's spell out what the heresy
yeah,
is.
Yeah, because let me tell you. I mean, when Sandro and I began researching, it was great fun, because we knew we were going to open up a detective story, and we really didn't know where it was going to end. Because, okay, here's the heresy, or here is the investigation, let's call it the scene of the crime, right? In the philosophical sense. The scene of the crime, mm-hmm. of the heresy is the Piazza St. Peter in front of the Vatican.
Mm-hmm.
And in the last 2 years, I'm sure everybody has seen it on television, extensively, because of the new Pope that has been elected, mm-hmm. Pope Francis. And the piazza is, in fact, I suppose, the People's Vatican, because although the Vatican proper is the structure that was built by Bramante and Michelangelo in the early 16th century, 17th century, the piazza itself is an open piazza. It is elliptical in shape. And strangely, it has a... Sorry, you're hearing this aeroplane.
I'm not hearing anything, Robert, no.
Okay, well, no, there's a jet plane that just flew outside my window. things happen here. So, you know, what intrigued me from many, many years is the fact that there is a genuine ancient Egyptian obelisk that stands right in the middle of this elliptical piazza.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I knew where the obelisk had come from. It had come from the city of the sun in Heliopolis. And just the name of it, the city of the sun, and you know, it's one of the strange things, you know, that nobody asked the question, but the question, well, I know a lot of people must have asked the question, but didn't pursue it. But the question is, why is it there? And why is the piazza elliptical? And why does it remind me of something? And I realized that every time I looked at this piazza, I began to see a diagram, but a diagram that was an astronomical diagram. Everybody knows that now, because of the Copernican and Keplerian theories, that that our solar system is formed by a central sun, and that the planets go around this sun in elliptical shape. But there was something else. So the piazza, in a sense, remind me of this, but there was something else that it took me a long time to click. The famous fountains that are adjacent to the obelisk. And this is where Sandro and I started clicking into, this is strange, let's look into who put them there, who are the protagonists, when this piazza was designed, who was involved with all this. And it opened up this immense investigation with the idea, here is the idea, if what we suspected was correct. Sorry, Sandro, I'm kind of setting the scene, and then we'll discuss together, if you don't mind. I think it's important. So the point is this. If what we suspected was correct, and what we were suspecting was that the piazza was designed along Kepler's first law of planetary motion. In other words, the heliocentric theory, the heliocentric theory of Copernicus, developed by Kepler, upon which all scientists today acknowledge and agree.
Just for the listener droppers, Copernicus had the idea that we went around the sun, but he thought it was circular, and Kepler stepped in and made it he made it oval, elliptical.
Yes, we're going to get into that in a minute. I just want to lay down what we call the heresy. Because indeed, if that piazza was designed along those principles, in other words, astronomical heliocentric theory, then it was a heresy. Because at the time it was designed by Bernini, by the way, in 1656, the Vatican had declared it since 30 years before a heresy punishable by death. So here we had this extraordinary layout of the piazza resembling, without a doubt, the Keplerian theory, and we'll get into more detail with Sandro in a minute. And but here was the problem. How is it possible that under the Pope's nose, the papal architect, the great papal architect Bernini, would have dared to design a piazza that was so obviously a representation of this heresy? So in we went, and we dived into the research. And I think this is where Sandro came extremely useful, because we had to dig out and go behind the scene with all the individuals that were involved in this plan. The main protagonist was Bernini, of course, the designer. But we discovered that there was a whole bunch of people around there. I think perhaps, Sandro, you can tell us a bit more about the proceeded with this research.
To be honest, remember, Robert, I was initially very skeptical about this this theory, but when we began reviewing all manuscript and original letters, documents, the thing became
you began to get more convinced.
Yeah, exactly. And
well,
you know, in at university in Sapienza, we have an historical library. The name is Biblioteca Alessandrina, created in 17th century, and I could access at that documents of this library. Looking at this this document, we found out many, many interesting relationships between among four characters: Alexander the Seventh, the Pope Kiji, and Gian Lorenzo Bernini, the architect of the Pope, the Jesuit. We had to remind the Jesuit order, Athanasius Kircher, Monk Athanasius Kircher, and Queen Maria Christina. All those characters deal with in the design of the piazza.
Yeah, what immediately made us feel very enthusiastic and more involved in thinking that the theory was correct is indeed the fact that when Bernini was commissioned by Pope Alexander VII to design this piazza, first of all, the Pope was in dire trouble. The Vatican was having serious financial problems. The population of Rome was in uproar that the Vatican had been spending and wasting a lot of money on these projects, and that people in Rome were starving. So this project was in fact a project that the population, even the cardinals, were very against this project. But the Pope went ahead, and this already indicated to us that there was a very strong reason for this Pope to move this project ahead. And when he called Bernini to design it, if I recall the dates well, it was sometime in February 1656, who was around Bernini and very close to Bernini and very close to the Pope, were these characters that you mentioned, Athanasius Kircher, the famous Jesuit astronomer come Egyptologist, the Pope Confessor, by the way. If you remember, the Pope Confessor was one of the key figures, Nicola Zucchi, who not only was the Pope's confessor, but he was one of the top architects, top astronomers of the time. And what I think really got us excited was that Zucchi had actually met Kepler. And not only met Kepler, but had taken to Kepler his very first telescope and had corresponded with Kepler. So there was no doubt at all that Zucchi and Kircher were extremely familiar with the heliocentric theory and Kepler's theory. So, and here comes this glamorous Cleopatra of the North. Boy, we had a lot of fun studying her. You remember, Sandro?
Yeah.
I mean, I think I would like to write a book about. I mean, there's many books written about her. But
this is Christina. Christina
of Sweden. Yes. I mean, just to. I mean, of course, we're not going to talk about the whole details of the book here. But Christina of Sweden is quite a character. She shocked the world by, first of all, she was the daughter of the Pope's worst enemy, because there was the Protestant Catholic wars at the time, and her father was the head of the Protestant army. And she shocked the world after her father's death and when she became queen to convert to Catholicism, which Pope Alexander VII was delighted to have this amazing PR event.
A victory.
Quite a lady. She spoke 9 languages. She had studied astronomy, in particular under René Descartes and Cassini and all these big astronomers of the time.
Wow.
And here she is in Rome, not only buddy-buddies with the Pope, who invited her to live at the Vatican, but she is one of the most closest friends and admirer of Bernini. And she, of all people, was extremely familiar with the new theories of Copernicus and Kepler. So the point that that became clearer and clearer was, how is it possible that all these astronomers who are so close to Bernini and the Pope, when Bernini designed the Piazza with the Pope's approval, it's amazing that none of them said, hey, but what you're designing here is the heresy. You're designing this layout that is strikingly similar to the Copernican theory.
I think
what's important for people, can you explain this, Sandro? I mean, exactly this Copernican theory, you know, with the focal points and all that, because you worked a lot on this.
Yeah. Okay. Copernicus designed the new first planet motion law, indicating that no more the Earth, but the Sun is the center of the our system, and each planet of our solar system go around the Sun in an elliptical orbit, and the Sun is one of the focus of this elliptic. And this is very strange, because the design of the Plaza at that time, Piazza San Peter, has just one fountain. You remember, Robert? Just one fountain was there.
I think that's the key. That's the very key to this this theory.
It's very strange, because nowadays Piazza San Peter has in the center of the piazza there is the ancient Egypt obelisk, and between two fountains. But at that time, there was just one fountain at one of the focus of the piazza. So it's very strange that all those astronomers didn't see the first love of plant motion. Yeah.
Indeed. I mean, it's very obvious from the measurements we took and the calculations we made. We're not the only ones. There were many architects who did the same, as you know, that Bernini used the existing single fountain to design the ellipse. So by doing that, and by keeping the obelisk at the center of the ellipse, he virtually designed on an architectural scheme Kepler's planetary first law of motion. So that's it. I mean, there is no ifs and buts about it. The question is, could it have been a coincidence? I mean, didn't he realize what he was doing? And if he didn't realize, surely all the astronomers, these top astronomers that were with him when he was designing this, would have noticed. So the big question is, of course, that tormented us for a long time, if you remember, was it's too obvious. It's too, you cannot escape attention once you see it. Therefore, why did they not say so? Why did they all keep quiet? And this was the difficult part of the book, is to go into the minds of these people, go into the minds of the people in that time.
In that time,
And we both realized that what we were dealing here was that on the one hand, people could not speak out. But let's put the time frame and the context of this heresy clear. When Copernicus published or had published the heliocentric theory, the Vatican immediately opposed it. It did not declare it yet a heresy. This was in 1540, if I recall well, 1548.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But then, who began to support it to the horror of the Pope at the time, Urban VIII, was Galileo. Galileo was a strong, outspoken supporter of this theory, but he was also a friend of the Pope. And the Pope kind of let it happen because it was just a theory, and as long as it was a theory, the Vatican opposed it, saw it as against the scriptures, saw it in a sense as a heresy, but not yet formalizing it. But then Galileo made the terrible mistake of publishing a book, a kind of fictional story where he made the Pope look ridiculous for not accepting this new proof, this new scientific theory, and to make things worse, Galileo developed the telescope.
Yeah.
And that changed everything, because the theory was no more a theory. You could actually confirm the theory.
Confirm.
It became a fact once the cardinals, and that's the point where you and I began to say, well, wait a minute, I mean, here is a very strange situation, because it is a fact. It is now a scientific fact that the telescope demonstrated the proof of the theory. And therefore, all these scientists that were in Italy, particularly the Jesuits, you know, this is the whole crux of the investigation, is that all the scientists around the Vatican were Jesuits. They were part of the Jesuit college. In fact, they were the only scientists at the time. There was no scientific establishment in those days. And so the Jesuits, who had a great interest in astronomy and mathematics, were the ones who realized, whoops, the Vatican is taking a position that is against the facts. In other words, they're saying that the scriptures, and therefore God, had it wrong. You know, God made a mistake. And it was an incredible situation, and an amazing conflict of conscience. And therefore, the worst happened is when Galileo was called to trial, the Pope, in order to punish Galileo, he was so furious about the insult that it is then that he declared it a heresy with a papal bull. And that was that. Once it was an official heresy, no matter if you believed in it, no matter if you even suspected its truth, you could not speak about it under the threat of the Inquisition, which meant, of course, either death or life imprisonment. So this is where I think you and I, Sandro, began to realize, yeah, we begin to understand. Nobody can speak about it. Nobody can talk about it. But then 30 years later, when the rest of the world, sorry, I'm going on a big line here, but I think I'll lay down the thing because I want Sandro now to talk about how we broke finally this mood. Because we began to understand slowly that 30 years after the Galileo trial, when every scientist in Europe had accepted the heliocentric theory, except the Vatican, and the Jesuit scholars of the Vatican could not concord to what they knew was the truth. And the question now is the Pope, Alexander the Seventh. Here he is. He's inherited this terrible, terrible conflict of conscience. Will he go down in history as the Pope who went against the truth?
Mm-hmm.
Or will he somehow fix it? You know, and this is what we believe he did. Here is the mood of this book, is that they left the evidence that they knew about it, but they, of course, could not go against the papal bull of the predecessor. So sooner or later, it was going to be seen. And it so happens that Sandro and I are the people who brought it on the surface. I wonder what's going to happen in Italy when the book is published next month, Sandro. Wow.
Any ideas what you guys think will be the reception in Italy?
Well, Sandro knows more about this than I do. But I mean, with a title like, can you tell us the exact title in Italian?
It's exactly that, the English translation is,
tell it in Italian because we love your accent, Sandro.
Le Eresia Vaticana is the title of the Italian version. I'd like to highlight that there are two others heresies in that time. We have to underline the Utopian movement and the Hermetic movement.
Absolutely, yes.
This is important to understand and to enter the minds of all characters dealing with the project, with the design of the piazza. Hermetic movement is something concerned with the attempt to restore the magical religion of the ancient Egypt. The Corpus Hermeticum was discovered in Greece and brought to Florence at the end of the 16th century, and Cosimo de' Medici let it translate very, very quickly. Because of he was afraid to die very, very after a while. And
indeed,
please, Robert.
You're absolutely right. I mean, and of course, this is the main first part of our book, is that the book starts in ancient Egypt, where we show how this religion, this magical religion of ancient Egypt, was written in a sense in those Hermetic texts, the texts of Hermes Trismegistus, and that the Florentine scholars, with Cosimo de' Medici as their patron, discovered this amazing vision of a religion of nature, a religion of magic, a religion which promoted the search for knowledge, that considered that humans could become divine. In other words, liberated man from the shackles of what had become the Catholic religion, The Catholic religion had become extremely oppressive under the Vatican. The scholars could not progress for fear of Inquisition. And therefore, they tried very hard. And this is one of the parts of the book where we show characters like Giordano Bruno and Piccola della Mirandola and various hermetic philosophers, as they were called at the time, trying desperately to convince the Vatican to reform, to adopt the hermetic texts and canonize them and make them part of the religious texts of Christianity. They firmly believed that they were part of the Christian prophecies, and therefore, if the Vatican could be convinced to adopt them, then it would allow all the new movements, like the scientific movements, the Copernican movements, all these exciting things that were happening at the time, the discovery of the new world, the various other scientific movements, the formation of the Jesuit College, all this to be liberated. But of course, the Vatican did not buy it. And we know how terrible it was for people like Bruno and others who were severely punished for this attempt. Bruno got burnt at the stake.
Ooh.
And so, you're right. I mean, this whole movement is also coupled. I'm glad you brought out, because I wanted to perhaps avoid going too much in those sectors, not to complicate our interview, but...
No, but Robert, excuse me. I think it's very important the relationship between Robert Bouval, an Egyptologist, and Rome. And I surprised when I knew that the biggest temple, religious temple in Rome is an Egyptian temple, the temple Isis. I think here in Rome, maybe, I think two or three people knew about this. I think we rediscover a very deep ancient Egyptian influence in the city of Rome.
Well, you know, Sandro, I mean,
do you remember the present Kirche made for Christina?
Indeed, yes.
Yeah. We wrote the obelisks in the book.
But you know, I mean, to put it in one simple phrase, you know, when you read this book, and of course there are other books, but this book goes deep and brings all this to the surface, is that the Roman Catholic religion is, in a sense, a plagiarism of the ancient Egyptian religion. I mean, all that has changed really was the names of the main
the figureheads
of the main players, the main protagonists. I mean, we have Isis and the child Horus as the Virgin and the child Jesus. We even have the myth of the divine birth with the star. We have the resurrection of Osiris linked to the resurrection of Jesus. So, yes. But it, in a sense, Roman Catholicism is wearing a kind of veil or a mantle that, that covers this ancient Egyptian religion. And this is what's coming out with this book. I mean, not just in terms of the religion itself and the philosophical, views, but literally with the architecture of Rome. Rome.
Exactly.
In a sense, emerges with this book, like the Piazza St. Peter. I mean, suddenly the Piazza St. Peter stopped being the Piazza St. Peter and becomes a hermetic temple, becomes a temple of the sun, which is the subtitle of our book. And suddenly the mantle is removed. And you see Rome as a classical city with Egyptian, ideologies, Egyptian layouts, even Egyptian alignments.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, to the sun and, so this is the exciting thing about this book, is that, you know, to get to it, of course, you have to go through the Hermetic tradition, how it influenced the Renaissance scholars, how they attempted to convert the Vatican, how, of course, and this was your strong point, Sandro, which without you, I don't think we could have gone very deep into this, was the utopian movement that was going on with Tommaso Campanella. And how Tommaso Campanella drilled the idea of creating Rome into a great solar center for the Pope to govern the whole world, the new world that was being discovered. And indeed, with his book, The City of the Sun, La Civita Solis, and you went, I mean, I think the sexiest part of that story, if one can use these words, is your research on the famous fresco of Sacchi.
Osaki, same, right?
Tell us a bit about that, I think that's it. That's what's coming out of all this, is that we're unveiling Rome. I mean, we are removing that thick veneer or thick mantle of Catholicism and showing what's underneath. And what's underneath is the hermetic religion. And the hermetic landscape.
Robert and Sandro, this is an incredibly important time, but incredibly interesting time as well. I mean, there was philosophical questions that were being suppressed and answered at the same time. Not only were they answered, they were suppressed right away, and there was people getting involved with conflicts of interest, and, you know, everybody was like in this strange state. It's like they were in stasis almost. They were just in this strange state where nobody could speak up, and, you know, they wanted to and couldn't, and, you know,
You're absolutely right.
It's right. I think we could have changed the title of the book in the hermetical tourist guide of Rome, of the Egyptian thriller of here in Rome. It's funny because you can read this book as a thriller.
And as a guide, as a guide to the secret Rome. I mean, the Egyptian Rome.
The Egyptian Rome.
But you know, I'd like to make a point. I've made a lot of points. I apologize, Sandro. I mean, you know, I know you're making a huge effort to speak in English, and I know how difficult it is, but you're doing extremely well, and I'm very proud that you are attempting your first, interview in English. I hope our listeners understand this, because I know the trouble. I've given interviews with you, Sandro, in Italian, and the tables turn. So I do apologize for butting in. But I think one point that needs to be made here is that the ancient Egyptians, particularly what we regard as the hermetic religion of the ancient Egyptians, is a religion of nature, is a religion that suits the nature of human beings. It is a religion that, rather than dictates and create doctrines that are against human nature, it does the opposite. It encourages and liberates humans to pursue their own knowledge, their own gnosis, their own search for God, and their own development. And therefore, this religion, which not only allows this, but is so close to nature, so close to the natural world, is the right religion. We use that term in the book, the religion of the world, the magical religion, call it what you like, but it is a religion that is universal, because every human being can relate to it. And so this book isn't just about the Renaissance. It sends a message, especially that now we have a new pope, who is a Jesuit of all things, which this book is intensely about the Jesuits' movement around the Vatican at the time. It sends a message that the world is confused. I mean, we are in a state of flux. People are losing faith in religious movements. People are fighting over religious ideologies. I mean, the Arab world is in a mess. New fanaticism and fundamentalism is cropping up. And the message that this book sends, and the attempt by the Renaissance scholars to bring this about, is a unified vision of a world religion, if we can call it that, a religion that is not is not dominated and controlled by a body of power like the Vatican or other bodies of other religious system, but religion of the individual, that the individual seeks his own direction, seeks his own way through the search for knowledge. And that is, I think, what the world needs now. And in a sense, perhaps, funny enough, I mean, Sandro and myself and others who are also pursuing this line of research are a bit like the Renaissance philosophers. We're trying to send this message that there is dire need for a global reform, a huge paradigm shift to take place, in the spiritual and intellectual minds of all human beings around the world, because this is what it's about. You know, that's what the reformers were trying to do in the Renaissance, to create a foundation for a movement that would be accepted globally. Am I right, Sandro? I mean, we began to see it, and I think we will pursue this research. We were talking about another book, by the way. Sandro?
Sí, I'm here. Yeah.
Well, you know, we're looking big into this. You know, we're not just writing books here. I mean, there is a real story here that is told that took place in the 16th and 17th century where people gave their lives. People pushed very, very hard to bring about a reformation, a global reformation.
Tell us a little bit.
They were
bit
attempting it, of course, within the Catholic system, because they themselves at the time were very religious. But Bruno, for example, realized that he was wasting his time. That no, there had to be a total reformation, a completely new cleanup of all the mess that's been going on for the last 2,000 years, and build on a new and yet ancient idea, which is the Egyptian model. Mm. The Egyptian model where for 3,000 years, a population living along the Nile were able to exist in harmonious conditions, in creative conditions. You know, I've just returned from Egypt with a group of people who were totally marveled by what they saw and what they saw of things 3,000-4,000 years ago. And yet it's there, this amazing creativity where it could only happen when the human being is free from the shackles of doctrines and dogmas that are unnatural to him. There you are. Made my talk.
Yeah.
Tell us about Bernini. What do we know about this guy as a person?
Ah, well, Sandro, you tell us.
Bernini is was a strange artist. He was convinced to be the best in the world as an artist. And do you remember, Robert, the mother of Bernini, Bernini's mother, wrote a letter to the Pope, asking him to give a look to her
to reprimand Bernini.
exactly
but
because,
you know,
please,
yeah, I was going to say, I mean, he was a typical Napolitano who who was at the head of the artistic world. I mean, but there's no doubt at all. I mean, when one sees his masterpieces, I mean, the man was a genius. There's no doubt about it. But he was also a bit of a scoundrel.
He was also very clever. He used dissimulation in he wrote some letters in which he explained how to use dissimulation to survive.
But you can't blame him. I mean, you know, even Christina, even of Sweden, even the Pope's confessor. People who were very close to the Vatican, and particularly the Pope, and particularly, by the way, Urban VIII and Alexander VII, they were very, very volatile popes. I mean, at the flick of a finger, they could send somebody to burn at the stake. Very, very dangerous people in a sense, because they had all the power. You know, so in a sense they were, I suppose one could call them religious dictators. I mean, they had all the power in their hand, and nobody in their right mind would want to contradict them, let alone promote things like the heliocentric theory and whatever was considered heresy. And Bernini was a genius at dissimulating, and hence the difficulty in understanding how, in view of this problem, they nonetheless went ahead and did this piazza.
Do you think Bernini may have wanted the legacy left behind, where he kind of corrected his mistake or corrected his involvement, or, you know?
I think that Alexander VII, the Pope who commissioned the piazza, he was a very educated man. Mm-hmm. And although, again, he too would not be speaking outright in favor of the heliocentric theory, it was well accepted at the time, and he knew it very well, that it was a truth. And here is the big conflict of that went in his mind. I mean, is he going to go down in history, like his predecessor, literally saying that God had it wrong? Because that's what it was. They were saying the scriptures that were interpreted as being the geocentric theory, was wrong. And therefore the scriptures, which were dictated by God to the scripture writers, was wrong. And, you can imagine in the mind of a pope. And therefore, but on the other hand, how could he go against a papal bull? What would you do if you were him? And, finally, he turned a blind eye. I think this is what happened, because there's no way this piazza could have been designed without his approval. And what we finally concluded in the last 2-3 pages of the book is that when Bernini said that the Pope had said that the piazza, to explain the design, the piazza represents the open arms of the Church, calling it the Mother Church welcoming the pilgrims, in other words, that the ellipse emanating from the building of the Vatican looks like huge open arms. Well, yes, symbolically, it is the truth. But it is only part of the truth. And this is where we finally understood this game of dissimulation. Is that, you know, when you go to court and you put your hand on the Bible and what you say, you don't say, I swear to tell the truth. No, you whole say, truth. I whole swear truth. To tell the truth, whole the truth. Whole truth,
yep.
And nothing but the truth.
Yeah.
Well, they just said we're going to tell the truth, which is one layer, which is true. It does look a bit like it can symbolize the arms, but they didn't say the whole thing. And that is dissimulation. This is when you understand this, when you understand this mental state of that period, then you understand that the Pope and Bernini and Christina of Sweden and the astronomers Zucchi and Kircher did this. They let it happen because they knew that they had to let it happen. The Vatican could not go down in history as having gone against the truth. And in many ways, this book brings it out, which is very curious. We're waiting to see what the Vatican will say now. Because it's literally under the Pope's nose. I mean, this new Pope, when he goes on the balcony now, if he does look at our book, he will say, well, I'm looking at the heliocentric theory. I'm looking at the Vatican as being that temple of the sun, the temple of the world, if you like, which is, in a way, a good thing. So let's see. I mean, this is what we expect, or we hope that somehow it will come out in Rome. How about it, Sandro? Sandro?
Sì, I'm here. Yeah. No, I was thinking about the question of the in Vatican at that time. The problem, I think, they thought is if one theory in the Holy Scriptures is wrong, how many else are true? This was the real problem issue
yes,
to face.
Well, you see, if you recall, I mean, Galileo was desperate in trying to convince Urban VIII, the Pope of the Inquisition at the time, that it wasn't the scriptures that were wrong. It was the interpretation of the scriptures by the Vatican.
Exactly.
They had interpreted it in a manner that fixed the geocentric theory that the earth was the center of the existing visible universe. Whereas Galileo said, look, all you have to do is reinterpret it. You just have to reinterpret them because the scriptures were not black and white. They weren't stating in a categoric way. They were interpreted in that manner because the church had made a mistake. But
the problem,
I think
the problem is that the last man who reinterpreted the Holy Scripture officially split into the Christianism, Martin Luther, after having reinterpreted the Holy Scripture, split Christianism in Protestant, Lutheranism, and Catholicism. This is the problem.
Yeah. Well, I think there's another book that will follow because we're letting this out to you, James. I mean, what we realize is that something odd was going on in the court of Christina of Sweden before she went to Rome.
What an incredibly intelligent lady this woman is. And when I read the book about this, this woman was so super intelligent.
Yes, but, you know, there's been a question whether she was a woman.
Really?
Of course, I firmly believe she was, but it's been doubted by many researchers that she probably was either hermaphrodite, or a man. In fact, there's a strange story about her birth is when she was born, her mother mistook her for a boy. Apparently she looked so much like a masculine baby.
Wow.
But anyway, that's, I suppose neither here nor there, but she remained a virgin, by the way. This is, has been proved. She never, never had any relationship, or deep relationship with a man. And therefore she was the virgin, if you like, the virgin returning to Rome, when she converted to Catholicism at the Vatican. The Pope actually gave her a new name. He called her Maria, which clearly indicates what the Pope had in mind. She was the returning virgin of the world, now in Rome. And there she was, this magnificent, fully educated, almost a Cleopatra figure who knew all the sciences. She was quite a character. I mean, I would dearly love to take a time machine and go and meet her. In fact,
she is the only woman barred into St. Peter, close to the other popes.
Yes, she's buried next to the popes. I mean, what an honor!
Wow.
But you know, one has to fix it at a very specific moment, and that moment is January and February 1656. Suddenly there was this gang, this very elite gang at the Vatican, this Christina of Sweden, who, by the way, had set up an astronomical observatory near the Vatican using Jesuit scholars. So there she is. She is buddy buddies with the Pope. I mean, she was seen with the Pope on a daily basis. There was even rumors that they might have had a fling together. She is buddy buddies with Bernini. I mean, she practically fell in love with Bernini. I mean, she was constantly with Bernini. She was actually at the deathbed of Bernini, the only woman, the only person who was at his deathbed. He only wanted to see her. So you can see the close relationship. And who was also there was the Zucchi, the confessor, and Athanasius Kircher. We have this gang of people almost seeing themselves as Providence, you know, an architect, a Isis returned to Rome, a Pope who is in charge and calling himself Alexander, and being flattered as being Osiris, by the way, by Kircher, who called him Osiris and called him Christina Isis, and Kircher, who fancied himself as Hermes Trismegistus. Sounds weird, but he did. So suddenly they're there and they're in control of the Vatican. They're literally at the head of the pyramid of Christendom. And here is the chance to leave a legacy, to leave the truth in a most grandiose manner. This is what I'm very convinced they did. And this is what we're exposing. And, suddenly, they achieved their amazing, covert plan, under the very nose of all of Christendom. And it's being exposed again. So that's the beauty of this book. And, do you have a copy, by the way, of it?
I do indeed, Robert. I'm looking at it.
You finished it?
Yeah. Well, actually, I didn't get it all finished, but because we started the show early, but pretty much finished. And you know what I like is, I'm looking at the ground plan, and this is for the listeners. The ground plan just explains everything. When you look at the schematics of the layout of the courtyard, and you know, it's a no-brainer, really. Well, if you have some basic understanding of Kepler's laws, and you have an understanding of the schematics and the diagrams, it's totally fascinating.
Well, I mean, Kepler's law is very simply. I mean, yeah, if you're going to represent Kepler's law in a diagram,
yeah,
you're going to have an ellipse.
Yep.
With a the ellipse has two main axes, the long one and the short one. The ellipse is like an oval.
Yep.
At the center of which is the center point. And because of the Kepler law, there is only one focal point operation where the sun occupies. Of course, an ellipse has two focal points, but the Keplerian law has only one focal point in use, i.e. where the sun is. So that's it. It's an ellipse with one focal point. And this is what Bernini did. And not only does it appear so, but mathematically, yeah, when you measure the piazza, as we did, it confirms that Bernini used that point, that which was a fountain adjacent to the obelisk, as the single focal point of that ellipse. And it's perfect. It works precisely, mathematically. So there is no doubt at all that when he took a pencil and paper and designed the layout of the piazza, he surely would have known, or at least all the people around him would have said, you're designing Kepler's planetary law of motion. There's no doubt at all. I mean, as you say, it sticks out. You know, you see it. You know,
it's not complex. It's schoolboy physics. It's not complex.
No, it's very simple. I mean, to realize the connection. The question is, yeah, of course, as we said from the very beginning, could it have been a coincidence? And the whole book was this deep investigation to reach a conclusion.
Well,
that it isn't, but then we had to explain how did they do it because of the heresy. And then we had to go into this dissimulation issue, and the gang, all this protagonists that are around, and how finally, sitting around the table, one imagines, they would have said, we've got to leave our legacy here. We've got to leave the fact that we were aware of the truth, but we did not want to expose it. You know, this is the magic of this book, is that you're left with this final question that they took, in a sense, their plan to the grave,
mm-hmm,
but they left it there in architecture.
I think the most important thing you guys do is the level of context. The context is so overwhelming, like on many counts of the heresy. It's like, you know, it's not just that it's just theory. This is basically measurable fact. It's insane that these guys didn't know about it. Like,
well, you know, I mean, oddly enough, many modern architects have pointed out that there is this resemblance between the Keplerian model and the design of the piazza. But because they didn't dig deeper into who was behind it and how it could have happened, they simply brushed it aside, saying, no, it's not possible. You know, they merely commented it in passing. But when you dig deep as we have, suddenly the whole thing, you know, I don't want to bring this up, but I will. It's a bit like when I discovered the Orion correlation theory, you know, the three pyramids with the three stars. I'm sure many people saw this. Perhaps they did. But nobody actually took it as being a valid connection, because Egyptologists were saying no, they didn't even look into this. So suddenly, when you bring something out like this with a properly backed up investigation, as I did with the pyramids, and as Sandro and I did with the with this Vatican heresy, then what appeared or might have appeared to others as being mere coincidence suddenly takes a completely different shape. I have no doubt at all, and I'm sure you, Sandro, as well, I'll let you say it, but I personally have no doubt at all that we have unveiled what was there, was a secret in plain view, if you like. Yeah. But we have now unveiled this invisible veil, if you like, and the piazza is now and will be the hermetic temple of the sun. I mean, that's it. That's how I look at it. And that's how Romans, or some Romans, we hope, will look at it when they read the book, because you cannot avoid it. It's there. You know, it suddenly emerges from this Catholic mantle that it was given and shines literally, as a temple of the sun. What do you think, Sandro?
No, it's absolutely right. The interesting thing is that each reader after reading the book can judge and decide. This is the most important thing. I think how we expose the facts. Each reader at the end of the book can judge by itself.
Indeed, and this is the I believe the quality of a good research, because this is what I do with all my books. You know, you present the arguments, you present the evidence in this case, like many of my books, but in this particular case, we have very first hand evidence. We went down to the source. We looked at letters, we looked at documents, we even looked at the original books of Kepler and Galileo. And with all this evidence and looking at the arguments we put, then the reader will decide, is it or isn't it?
Right.
And in my mind, it's very difficult to see it as a coincidence once you have examined the evidence. So the beauty of it is that the Vatican becomes, in a sense, something else now. Well, not something else. It's still the Vatican, of course. But it has in front of it the model of a temple, the true temple of the sun, because there's many temples of the sun around the world, even in Egypt. But the true model is the Keplerian model, and they've got it there. It's in massive architectural form with a beautiful Egyptian obelisk in the center. And it's there, you know. I mean, the cover of the book does it, you know. You see the sun shining on top of the obelisk, and it looks like an architectural model of the solar system or a solar temple. There you are. I mean, that's the final point.
A solar talisman, Robert. A solar talisman.
Ah, yes. I knew you were going to bring this word up. The talisman.
Yeah.
The talismanic temple of the... Okay. I suppose you could say it is the hermetic, talismanic, magical temple of the sun, which represents the religion of the world. A true model, if you like. None of these doctrines of by patriarchs. It is looking at the true model of our world, represented in a Templar architectural form, with ideologies. This is what counts, with the ideologies behind this, i.e., that this hermetic temple represents a belief in a natural religion that is suitable to the individual. So that to me is what this piazza now means to me when I look at it. And I hope that readers will after reading the book and looking at all the evidence, getting into the hermetic mental state, because this is what it's about, the state of a mental of a hermetic thinker, to think in those terms. to think in terms that encourage you and encourages others around you to explore your inner and outer world, to discover who you are, to discover what we are, to discover. And this is the centerpiece. So when people go there at this piazza, we hope that it will stimulate by what you said, Sandro, the talismanic effect. Mm-hmm. Being inside that environment stimulates that form of thinking.
Yeah.
That is talisman, huh?
Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. We're at the top of the hour, guys. The most obvious question is, where can we get a copy of the book? Robert, give us your website again. And Sandro, if you have a website, please.
All right. Let me do this one. My website is www.robertboval.co.uk, and you'll find all the books there and the Vatican Heresy as well. But of course, Amazon, the likely place. You'll find it on Amazon. It was published a few months ago in English, and will come out, and Sandra will tell us now more about the Italian edition, which is coming out very soon. Is that right, Sandra?
Yeah, right. In next May, Italian version will be published and delivered you can find on amazon.it and in all libraries and bookshop.
Can you give your website? You have it on your website?
It's still working, not yet.
Okay. Yeah, by the way, Sandro, I'm sure you're talking to Adriano Forgione, our publisher, and you're talking to Pino Morelli.
Sì.
Pino Morelli, who has called me yesterday to tell me that they're trying to organize a launch of the book in May.
Yeah.
I think they fixed it on 17th of May, where we will give a talk near the Vatican at a venue and then take all the guests to the Piazza St. Peter.
Sì. We're organizing a hermetical tour.
Gathering.
Yeah.
That's going to be interesting.
Come and join us, James.
Wow.
We'll be at the Piazza St. Peter.
I actually have to go see I have to go see Italian friends sometime soon. You never know.
Time, huh?
Well, excellent. Yeah.
Wow.
Actually, why not? Why not do a transmission from there?
Yeah.
Why not, Robert? This sounds like a great little tour. Yeah, this sounds like interesting.
Well,
leave that with me.
It's being organized by two of our publisher and a event organizer, Pino Morelli.
Same.
I talked to him yesterday, and he plans to do it on the 17th of May, but I'll confirm this to you later. And the idea is that during the morning, the book is being presented and launched in a venue near the Vatican. And then all the guests will be taken literally to the Piazza St. Peter. Hopefully we have a nice bright afternoon after lunch, and we will
waiting
walk around.
I'm going to have to
waiting for the sunset in Piazza St. Peter.
Beautiful. I'm going to have to brush up on my Italian, I think.
Well, I'll help you around, don't worry.
Because my vocabulary is C at the moment, S-I-C. That's about it.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, James, this was great fun.
It was great fun, Robert. And, nice to do something different again today. And, I wish you every success with the book, guys. Sandro, pleasure to talk to you as well. It really was nice to meet you. And you never know, we might meet in Roma. I wish you every success with the book. It's a fascinating read. Everybody get out and get a copy of The Vatican Heresy. Bernini and the Building of the Hermetic Temple of the Sun. I love the artwork on the book cover as well, guys. The artwork is beautiful.
Thank you, James.
We'll congratulate our designer, our friend Sandro Mainardi of Florence, who is one of the best book designer.
Yeah, right.
Well, James, always good to talk to you.
You too, Robert.
We'll talk next time more about our pyramid story.
Yeah, for sure, Robert, for sure. You take care, guys.
Thank you, James.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.